From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with film director Paul Morrissey. Three of the underground classics he directed, that Andy Warhol produced, are now in circulation on home video. Plus, he's got a new film opening this week about the misanthropic side of Ludwig van Beethoven. Gerald Clark can now call himself the biographer of writer Truman Capote, but writing this biography was more difficult than he expected. Coming up, he describes the 14-year project. Bob Dylan has a new album, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Big, a fantasy about body switching starring Tom Hanks, Elizabeth Perkins, and Robert Loggia. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Andy Warhol and Paul Morrissey met in the mid-60s. At the time, Morrissey was an insurance clerk and film buff who made short silent films on the side. Morrissey went to work as the assistant on Warhol's films. A couple of years later, Warhol gave up directing for producing, and Paul Morrissey took over the writing and directing of the films. Three of those films, Trash, Flesh, and Heat, have just been released on home video. These are underground film comedies. They were crudely made with improvised dialogue and the kind of subject matter that couldn't have come out of Hollywood at the time. The characters were oddballs and misfits who all had explicit sex on camera. In the mid-70s, Warhol produced Morrissey's comic versions of Frankenstein and Dracula. In 1984, Morrissey made Mixed Blood, a film set in the abandoned buildings in Lower Manhattan that were taken over by drug dealers. Morrissey co-wrote and directed a new film, which opens this week. It's called Beethoven's Nephew, and it presents Beethoven as a great composer, but a miserable human being. I spoke with Paul Morrissey from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we talked about his new film, we discussed his underground film days. Here's an excerpt from Heat.
Okay.
I'll get it. Hello? Who's this? Barney? Barney, listen. I didn't do anything. Listen, you just came over here with me to my mother's house. Listen, I'm coming right home. Don't you dare take the pills. Listen to me. You need me more than the pills. Oh, go on, for God's sake. Listen, don't you dare touch those pills. Stay away from them. No, I'm not doing anything with him. Just listen, Bonnie, listen to me. It's Jessica. Listen, wake up. Wake up!
You started making movies at a time when independent filmmaking was still really in its infancy. Was it a real exciting notion to you that you could just, you know, pick up a camera yourself and make your own movies, that you didn't have to go to Hollywood, you didn't have to do a major motion picture to make a film?
Yes, you're exactly right. It was very exciting to think you could do that. And you could do that then, but you can't do that now. In fact, I think it was never done before or since. It was, in that sense, an almost unique period. These films were made for unbelievably low costs. Even today, I wouldn't even say what they cost. And that they traveled to every city in the world. Europe, France, in Paris, in London, in Munich, in Berlin. They went to Spain. They went all over the place. And they traveled throughout the United States. These films were made by myself and a person on the sound. They were not made by 4 people or 30 people or 80 people. They were entirely made by me. I photographed them. I wrote them. I told the actors what to do. I edited them. I made up the ad. And then I got the distributor to put them into theaters. I even made up the contracts for the distribution agreements. I still own these films with the Andy Warhol estate. It's a 50-50 arrangement. The films were made, financed by Andy, made by me, and we would divide any profits. They were so inexpensive, the profits came in very quickly. This type of filmmaking, totally independent of everybody, I didn't have to deal with other members of the crew. There was no crew. There was a person on the sound, and I was on the camera. Was really unique, and I think these films that have come out on video, people today see them, they still look very fresh, I think, because there's nothing quite like them ever happened again. They were made so totally independent of anybody. So whenever I see my films, I see myself making decisions as to what's funny, who is funny, who should be in front of the camera, how the story should go. The things that are not in the story are more noticeable than what's there. I avoid melodrama, I avoid car chases, I have no killings, I have no violence, I have humor, and I hope. And that humor, if it gets a laugh at one point, it somehow is able, I think, to get a laugh later on. But the interest, on top of the humor, you want also some sort of slight little feeling of, let's say, sympathy for the people, too.
Did you ever think when you were making them that Trash, Flesh, and Heat would end up being available for home viewing?
Oh, well, yeah, I guess no reason why not. There was nothing, terribly shocking about them. They just had little nudity scenes and things like that. But the films are all comedies, and, my attitude now is never... It was no different then. These sequences of people getting involved with some sort of foolish drugs or sex or any of the sort of fads of the 60s, all those horrible, now become institutions and establishment institutions today, they always seem to be foolish and a wonderful source of the comedy and the foolishness of people. And they were done never in any serious vein. The movies were serious. All comedies, I think, can be serious if they're meant to be. And I think comedy is a very serious business. But the individual things that people thought were a little bit shocking were usually, almost always, in my case, things that were the biggest laughs.
Well, it's funny. Some of the scenes are almost anti-erotic in the sense that they're about... people too bored or too wasted to even get sexually aroused enough to have sex.
Well, you're just noticing that now 20 years later. People didn't seem to pay attention to that before, although it's so totally obvious. I think they were totally anti-erotic. I think eroticism in movies is a hoot. It's totally ridiculous. It was then, it was before, and it's worse now. It's just the stupidest thing in the world. Now, many years later, people are even leaving it out, thank God. But when it rears its stupid head, in movies still, and people huff and puff and heavy breathe and go into clinches and roll around on mattresses with the clothes off, it's ridiculous. And it was then, and God knows I never did it seriously.
Even though you saw your films as anti-erotic, did nevertheless some people come to your movies as if they were porn movies, just to see naked people?
I suppose some people do, sure. Who knows? The media invents a kind of category for things, and you never know how people interpret them. Their impressions of things come less from what they see than from what they're told to look for.
Did you ever have trouble finding places to screen your early movies because of the nudity?
No, not at all. No, we made a lot of experimental in the sense of experimental to us, they weren't experimental in their nature, they were very simple, but they were tests for our sketches, and they weren't, lively enough to be shown all over, so we just showed them in one little tiny theater in New York for ourselves, really, see if there's any audience reaction. No, those films, those three films that are out of video, were shown all over the world and... every city and the big cities and everything.
Did you see those early movies as a reaction against a certain pretentiousness in movies?
Yes, certainly that kind of film is a reaction against pretentiousness, but a pretentiousness in life. The hippie thing is not really something really looked down upon and laughed at. It's something that's become the establishment now. Bruce Springsteen is considered some sort of, genius on a scale with Beethoven or somebody. I mean, this is, to me, ludicrous. But he's the same old screaming rock and roll act that's been around for 20, 25 years. And now it's taken deadly seriously. Then it was beginning to be taken seriously. I think those attitudes, the tone of voice of those people screaming their lungs out with some message for the youth of the nation... are very funny and silly and fatuous and pretentious. And so they were reactions against the pretensions of the period.
Director Paul Morrissey is my guest, and three of his films, Heat, Flesh, and Trash, have just been released on home video, and he has a new movie called Beethoven's Nephew, which will have its theatrical premiere in the United States this week. Do you love the glamour of Hollywood films?
Well, you mean the glamour that once existed in
Hollywood? Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, of the earlier
Hollywood
films. I don't love
it. I think it was a wonderful idea, and it was very entertaining, and it was a good idea, and it was an unpretentious idea. There is no glamour today, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of pretension. You either the movies today are either between total childishness, you know, aimed at 4, 5, 6, 7 year olds. Of course, getting the entire yuppie market—that's sort of the age level. Or they're unbelievably pretentious. There's no sort of continuous kind of light, vaguely, if you want to use the word sophisticated, tone of voice left in movies.
Well, I asked you about glamour because I figured you probably liked the earlier Hollywood films, yet your movies are kind of anti-glamour in a lot of ways. Instead of being larger than life, the early movies are like more flat than real life in a way.
Well, I think they were more realistic than other movies, but at the same time, I wanted to have an antidote to that realism at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what I tried to do always, when I told these very realistic stories, which I knew I could tell because nobody else was telling them in a way, so it was a vacuum, as it were, I would always cast them with the most inappropriate people to be found in these situations, people who looked better than they looked in Hollywood in the 30s and 40s. In other words, I always used idealized people to play the most realistic situation. So it wasn't glamour, but I mean, I prefer the link to a theatrical past that doesn't go around saying, look how realistic we are, because I think that's a phony pretense also to claim realism, realism, realism. So
in your early movies, you really didn't use trained actors. Why not?
If the part called for an actor who had some training, or, well, what do you mean training? I don't think there's such a thing as a trained actor. It's like a trained SEAL.
Well, there is. I mean, a lot of actors go to acting school and start off, you know,
no good actors
on the stage before making movies.
Well,
you have a lot of experience
acting,
before starting.
That's called experience acting. Trained actors, somehow this idea of coming from these unbelievable acting schools. Ridiculous. I just finished this wonderful autobiography by Ely Kazan, who invented and started the Actors Studio.
Mm-hmm.
And pages and pages of the book are his disgust with what's come out of acting schools. And he talks about, he says, there's a sentence in the book I really like. He said, when I hear about these actors going to a master class, he said, I want to vomit. Well, it's been a horror what's happened. He quotes Stella Adler, this remark, who was an acting teacher. When Lee Strasberg died, she said, American acting has been, the damage he caused to American acting will take 100 years to repair. And there was in New York, well, the time we were making films, certainly, and certainly continues, this ridiculous industry of people attending classes and working on their private emotions and private moments and totally killing any life that possibly could come out of the actor, the performer, through these horrible classes and training, so-called training exercises. And they're artificial, they're mannered, they're phony, and they're boring.
How did you cast people for your early movies?
If they were not boring.
On the screen or off the screen? It sometimes
No, on the screen. Very many interesting people in front of a camera are not interesting off camera, but that's just the way it is. You know, you cast somebody who has an effect on camera. You have to recognize what will have an effect on camera.
Were you sometimes interested in casting people who were interested in movies and in glamour in a way, but were really misfits kind of themselves?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I was interested in casting people that I thought would make the story work. I was interested in characters. I was creating the characters. I was making the characters up. And when you work in films in this way, and you don't write the character like Dickens wrote a character, Jane Austen wrote a character, if you don't write that kind of character, you embellish the character with the personality traits of the performer.
How did you start working on films with Andy Warhol?
Oh, Andy had seen some little tests I had done, little things, and I'd seen some things he had done, and he said, well, I like to film something every week, which was very unusual, very extravagant in those days, and he said, I have a sound camera now, and I need help. And if you're not doing anything, come around. Well, you can help me push the button on the camera. That was it.
His early films were films, you know, of like one shot for 12 hours or so.
Not really, no. What? That's one film,
one
or maybe
film, yeah.
Two films.
Were you
and
into
that's
that
the
kind
one,
of stuff?
That's the one journalists like to mention endlessly, 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 endlessly. But, you know, there were maybe 300 others beside that, and they don't get mentioned so much. So he did that so that journalists would mention it and pay attention to him because he started from nowhere. And it was a very clever move because... Here, 20 years later, people still mention the one that doesn't move.
You started off as Warhol's assistant, then you ended up directing all the films, and he produced them. Did you ever feel, you know, his name was so attached to some of the movies, some people thought that they were his instead of yours? Did that ever trouble you?
They were listed correctly in the ads. Andy Warhol presents such and such, 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 written, photographed, and directed by me. If journalists who don't pay much attention to things... want to keep confused
about it. I'm not talking about journalists.
I'm talking
about people in general.
That's what happened. Journalists would spread this idea that they were Andy's films. Just people in general. You'd be surprised. If Andy didn't spread it, the ads in the paper were correctly, listed. Andy Warhol presents. But, you know, he was a celebrity name, and journalism lives or dies on celebrity value.
Were you into the party scene yourself?
Party scene, no. No, I rather hated it. There was Andy in the art world and everything. He had enormous masochistic streak in him where he went to a party every night, it seems. You don't know how he did it, how he was able to do it, but he didn't expend much energy when he went there because he went there and sat there like a wallflower. He was really very shy, and he never participated in anything. So he felt it was... important for his name to be out there and be a part of the scene. And he really dedicated himself to it very... he was going out every night of his life till the day he died, I think. The day he went to the hospital. But, you know, that was his thing. I don't enjoy it. I never knew anyone who enjoyed it. But I don't think he enjoyed it, but he did it.
How did you part with him, stop making movies with him?
Well, producers asked me to make bigger films, budget films, and they were putting up the money, so there was no reason for Andy to put in any money or participate.
Mm-hmm.
Andy didn't want to finance the films anymore because they became a little more expensive than he was able to finance. Plus, he got very busy doing his art. There was a slump during that period. Not a slump, but... Around the period I went off to write scripts for other people and things like that, he got extremely busy in his art business.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you about a new movie. You've got a new movie that opens this week called Beethoven's Nephew. But before we get to it, we're going to take a short break. My guest is director Paul Morrissey. Three of his films, Heat, Flesh, and Trash, all produced by Andy Warhol, have just been released on home video. And his new film, Beethoven's Nephew, opens this week. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Director Paul Morrissey is my guest. Since the movies of yours that I had been familiar with, you know, your underground films, horror films, a film about shooting galleries in New York, you know, drug shooting galleries, the Beethoven's Nephew seemed like such an improbable subject for you to take on for a film.
I don't think any filmmaker finds any subject improbable. You know, perhaps you know. I've been identified more with contemporary settings, I suppose, but Frankenstein and Dracula were costume comedies. But this was simply a biographical film about, I thought, a very interesting character, a man of extraordinary gifts and talents who was almost, in proportion, lacking any gifts or talents in real life. He was his life is such a sad.
You're talking about Beethoven himself, not the
Yes, yeah. The life of Beethoven, once you get involved in reading about it, is unbelievably. I hate to use the word pathetic because it sounds like I'm patronizing him or something, but he was a man who was closed off from human contact with other people through a bitter, nasty, hostile personality. That, of course, to start out in life as a person like that, and then become very famous and very money crazy and everything, rather disreputable in his dealings with people regarding money. He then goes deaf. And from the age of 23 to 57, he spends his most of his life unable to hear the music he's writing. He mistrusted and disliked people. And his mistrust and dislike of people escalated to such an extent with the deafness that it's an extraordinary story that he was able to go on as long as he did.
Well, you get at all of this through having a story about his nephew who Beethoven gets custody over after the nephew's father dies.
Right.
And it's
sort of
funny,
like the Baby M case.
Right. The nephew's into writing and writing for the stage, and Beethoven thinks that that's really like trashy pop art.
Prostitutes act. Right, that's right. He had a terrible opinion of all human beings, but when it came to women who weren't entirely well-behaved with a title and, you know, up in a house conducting themselves to all appearances very correctly, he felt they were all diseases. His word, over and over again, he uses this word. He has the terms pestilential breath, fire-breathing dragon. His references to women are rather comical, but he lived in a period which is we're approaching in our own period, which is rather interesting. Comparison, inevitable comparison, where people were spreading sexually transmitted diseases. Then, more than now, and there's a movie about Mozart that shows him dying in bed, and doesn't even bother to mention what killed him. You'd have no idea why he's dying, but he died of syphilis. But Beethoven was affected at his death by the pneumonia and cirrhosis of the liver, but the syphilis probably was a factor, but he seems to have inherited the syphilis from his mother without any real contact with other people. So his deafness, which was the infection due to the syphilis, according to medical theory on his case, was, a factor in his phobia against contact with other people.
Okay, well, let's hear a clip from the movie. Let me see if I can set this up. This takes place at a masked ball, and Beethoven wants custody of his nephew, and he's fighting with his nephew's mother. He doesn't want his nephew to see his mother. So they're at this masked ball fighting. As they fight, the nephew is entering the masked ball with a woman, an actress, who is soon to be his lover, played by Natalie Bay.
You slut!
You're mad! Leave me alone! Leave me alone!
Would you believe it? The party has hardly begun and already some drunk. He's starting a fight over some whore.
If you want to leave, let's do it right now, please.
No, let's stay. This might be amusing.
I'm afraid that drunk you're talking about is my uncle.
Oh.
And that whore is my mother.
We just heard Natalie Bay in that clip, and I think a lot of our listeners will know her from her performances in La Balance and The Return of Martin Guerre. Working with an actress like her is really different than working with the more inexperienced actors who you worked with in your early films. Are you more interested now in working with more established actors than you used to?
Working with actors like her is no different than working with inexperienced actors. You work with actors, performers, the same way no matter who they are. You ask them to do something and they do it, and you you say whether they're doing it the way it seems good or the way it doesn't seem good. There's no difference.
Yeah, but I think in your early films you had a real kind of laissez-faire attitude in a way about
I was doing contemporary stories, and I wanted a more contemporary, realistic approach to the way people spoke to one another, and so the things were, dialogues were improvised upon a set format and, you know, story given to the performers, the actors. And there was a different way of doing it, sure, but I'm dealing with contemporary comedies about life and other things. But those early films utilized an enormous amount of improvised dialogue. This film doesn't. I haven't used improvised dialogue for 15 years.
Now, you're working on another film, too, which will be opening in the near future.
It's called Spike of Bensonhurst. It's about family comedy of teenagers in Brooklyn neighborhoods, dominated the kind of neighborhoods where mafia influence is very strong and where the entire neighborhood is really controlled by the mafia. And it's just a human comedy about families. I mentioned to someone I saw somewhere that it's, in a way, it's no different than Beethoven. It's about the foolish extremes people go to within their own families.
Sylvia Miles is in it. You worked with her.
She's a good actress. Very funny. And she's a very fine actress, and she knows where the laughs are, and I always like that with an actor.
One last question. Have you looked back at the early films that were just re-released on home video?
Yeah.
How do you think they hold up?
I think they're just as funny today as they were then. I think the foolishness of human personality, which I was looking for then, and I hope I touched upon, is still foolish and funny. I think that if you try to be truthful to human personality, and it's in its rather silly moments, you get something that doesn't age. I think comedies in all film history are the ones that survive the 30 years, the 40 years, the 50 years, even the silent films. It's the comedies of Buster Keaton and people like that who are, that are still watched. Well, the serious films, the dramas, become foolish and, you know, the issue passes. But the issue in comedy is human personality, and that stays the same 50, 80, 100 years later. So I think those films are still funny, and I think they, as a side effect, they seem to represent, I think, a little record of the way people thought and the way they didn't give a damn and the way they thought they could do whatever they wanted and get away with it. And all the time they're doing that, they're making their lives more miserable as they go along. I don't think that's a story that dates so much. So I rather enjoyed them.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking
with us. Okay, thank you, Terry.
My guest has been film director Paul Morrissey, and three of his early films, produced by Andy Warhol, Heat, Flesh, and Trash, have just been released on home video. His new film, Beethoven's Nephew, will have its U.S. premiere this week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with the manager of the Baltimore Orioles, Frank Robinson. He's one of the few blacks in management positions in baseball today. He's also a member of the Baseball Hall of Fame. I hope you can join us. Here's music by Beethoven.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Gerald Clark describes his 14-year effort to complete the biography of writer Truman Capote. In the beginning, he'd imagined leisurely conversations in posh restaurants, but instead he witnessed Capote's long decline and death from drug abuse. Who does the best Bob Dylan impersonation? Rock critic Ken Tucker says Dylan himself does a superb job on the new album Down in the Groove, coming up a review. And there's a new version of the body-switching fantasy. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Big, starring Tom Hanks, Elizabeth Perkins, and Robert Loggia. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Today, independent counsel Lawrence Walsh announced that he will try Oliver North first in the Iran-Contra case. Yesterday, U.S. District Court Judge Gerhard Gesell ordered that all four of the defendants in the case be tried separately. Today, Walsh suggested an innovative way to avoid four separate trials. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In picking North as the first trial target, Walsh has selected the defendant whose case most thoroughly lays out the Iran-Contra story. And if for any reason there ends up being only one trial, if, for example, there's a pardon after the first trial, then Walsh would have set out for the public the most complete results of his investigation. Moreover, most legal experts believe that Walsh's strongest case is against North, that North, for example, is charged with profiting financially from his dealings in the Iran-Contra affair, while Poindexter is not. Still, Special Prosecutor Walsh asked the judge today to allow him to try North and Poindexter together. Walsh suggested that there be two separate juries in the courtroom, and, for example, Walsh said that if any evidence must be heard in the North case that harms the constitutional rights of Poindexter, then the Poindexter jury can be excused for that testimony and vice versa. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
A federal appeals court today set aside its own landmark ruling that struck down the Army's ban on homosexuals. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has referred the case of a discharged gay soldier to an 11-member panel of the court for a new hearing, and it nullified its own 2-1 decision in favor of the gay soldier. That decision was the first by a federal appeals court saying that gays are entitled to the same protection against discrimination as racial minorities. No date has been set for a new hearing, and no reason was given for today's reversal. Michigan is close to becoming the first state in the union to make it a felony to enter into a surrogacy parenting contract. Sally Isley reports from member station WKAR.
The Michigan legislature has approved a bill that sets penalties of up to 5 years in prison and or a $50,000 fine for those who arrange surrogate parenting contracts. The legislation outlaws such contracts and the exchange of money in surrogate parenting arrangements. Michigan has been the focus of much of the surrogate parenting debate because it is home to Noel Keene, the attorney who has arranged many of the contracts, including the agreement that resulted in the controversial Baby M case. The sponsor of the legislation, Senator Connie Binsfeld, says she believes the bill will put an end to the problem in Michigan. She says it's the toughest legislation in the nation, and she hopes it will be a model for other state and federal legislation. The bill now goes to the governor for his signature. For National Public Radio, Sally Isley in East Lansing, Michigan.
President Reagan told a group of 250 business leaders today that drug use is a corporate crisis and a national catastrophe. He urged employers to get tougher on drug use, and he praised what he called a change in attitudes about drugs.
It is this change in attitudes that I believe makes total victory in the war on drugs not just possible, but ultimately certain.
The president is waiting to hear from his National Drug Policy Board and from a recently appointed commission that is supposed to come up with solutions for the drug problem within 45 days. Yesterday, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater admitted that the efforts of the two groups had fallen behind schedule. South African President P.W. Botha, citing the revolutionary climate in his country, today renewed the 2-year-old national state of emergency for 12 more months. Botha said the government needed to extend the state of emergency to quell escalating violence linked to the government's apartheid policies of racial discrimination. In a statement from Cape Town, Botha said the government has achieved considerable success in controlling the incidence of violence and unrest, but he said it is apparent that there still exists a notable revolutionary climate in the country. He said the renewal is effective for 1 year unless conditions change. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's not easy to peg Bob Dylan. The man who once had a whole generation singing The Times They Are a-Changin' keeps changing himself, everything from singing born-again music to touring with the Grateful Dead. Dylan just released a new album called Down in the Groove. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The cover of the new Bob Dylan album, which features a cloudy portrait of the artist strumming an acoustic guitar, is festooned with stickers. One informs us that Dylan is a, quote, 1988 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. Another sticker, containing more than 250 words of hollow hype, announces that this album contains, quote, a set of songs and ideas worthy of the Dylan legacy. Legacy is capitalized as if it was a storehouse of genius that you could go visit, the thinking rock fan's Disneyland. But what are these ideas worthy of the Dylan legacy? Could they be contained in, oh, say, this song? That's the ugliest girl in the world, and yes, he really did say, the woman I love, she's got a hook in her nose. Dylan needed to team up with the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, Robert Hunter, to come up with that one. Over the course of the 80s, we've come to expect not very much at all from Bob Dylan. One reason he was eminently worthy of induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is that his greatest work is probably behind him. It's just a matter of maintaining the old legacy, making sure that Blowin' in the Wind gets dusted occasionally and that Like a Rolling Stone doesn't fall off its pedestal and break. Fortunately, Dylan himself doesn't feel this way about his work. He apparently sees that legacy as an ongoing operation because he keeps releasing records. In fact, his last two albums, Infidels and Knocked Out Loaded, contained a few excellent ornery songs. This new one, Down in the Groove, contains at least one first-rate rock song called Had a Dream About You, Baby. In addition to Bob Dylan doing an absolutely superb Bob Dylan impersonation on that song, Mitchell Froom does an exceptionally witty Al Cooper impersonation on the electric organ, and Eric Clapton plays some uncanny Eric Clapton-style guitar. I think that song works both on its own and as a very funny self-parody, an ironic echo of the younger Dylan at his most ferocious and bluesy. The other clear high point of Down in the Groove couldn't be more different in style and tone. It's Dylan's interpretation of the Stanley Brothers bluegrass classic called Rank Strangers to Me.
I wandered again to my home in the mountain, where in youth early dawn I was happy and free. I look for my I never could find them. I found they were all rank strangers to me. Everybody I met seemed to be a rank stranger. No mother or dad, not a friend could I see. They knew not my name, and I knew not their faces. I found they were all rank strangers to me.
It's very impressive, I think, the way Dylan can summon up the ghost of his own earliest folk music in singing that Stanley Brothers song, accompanied only by his own guitar and the bass playing of Larry Klein. Down in the Groove is an almost perversely varied collection, with Dylan songs mixing with covers of tunes like the old folk song Shenandoah and Wilbert Harrison's Let's Stick Together. The closest Dylan comes to something that might turn up on a conventional pop radio station is Silvio, a cheerfully confusing narrative that features moony backup vocals by Jerry Garcia, Bob Weir, and Brent Midland of the Grateful Dead. It sounds like Dylan's way of telling us that, Hall of Famer or not, he's not dead, and he's determined to keep his audience unsure of what to expect next.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Stake my future on a hill of the past. Looks like tomorrow is a coming on fast. Ain't complaining about what I've got. Seen better times, but who has not? Silvio, silver and gold. Won't buy back the beat of a heart grown cold. Silvio, I gotta go. Find out something only dead men know.
This is Fresh Air. When Gerald Clark began writing Truman Capote's biography long before the writer's death in 1984, Clark never thought he would end up being a chief witness to Capote's physical and emotional decline. Although Capote is admired and respected for such books as In Cold Blood and Breakfast at Tiffany's, he's generally remembered as a literary figure obsessed with self-promotion, high society, and gossip. Capote had given so many interviews and was such a frequent guest on television talk shows that I asked Gerald Clark, as a biographer, what was left to learn about the man.
Truman had given many interviews, and he could be very honest, but at the same time, he hid a great deal. In other words, he could talk about some of the things most people are very reticent about, such as his sex life. Everybody knew he was homosexual, and he wasn't ashamed of it. It didn't affect him, didn't bother him in any way whatsoever. Things that other people might have talked about, Truman wouldn't talk about. Or it became very difficult for him to talk about some of his emotional relationships. He really, in a curious way, was very secretive. Some people who seem most open, like Truman, are really sometimes the most secretive.
Capote was one of the most photographed writers of his generation, as you point out in the book. He was also one of the most frequent talk show guests.
Yes.
And
one of the earliest, too.
Yeah, and I think maybe he was one of the first writers of his generation, along with his rivals Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer, who really understood how to use television.
I think Truman probably understood it best. Although, in my opinion, Truman was not at his best on television. He became a bit of a clown. He knew the medium. He knew that to attract attention, you had to be outrageous. You had to shock. You had to say things that were not always absolutely true. In other words, you couldn't have shadings of gray. Everything had to be black and white. Truman knew that very well, and he became an instant celebrity once he was on TV. But in a sense, he also became something of a clown when he did that. And I'm sorry in some ways that he did it.
Do you think that worked to his detriment as a writer?
Yes, I do. I don't want to take a too high-toned idea about what a writer should do, because I think writers can do lots of things. But I think people don't realize what a good writer Truman really was because of this image they have of him as an entertainer from TV. And I think that's too bad.
His most widely read book was In Cold Blood, about the murder of a family in Kansas. The story and the setting was really so outside of his regular life. What attracted him to that story?
He wanted to get away from the things he had been writing about. He had just written Breakfast at Tiffany's, which was a story about New York of a social comedy, really. And he was attracted to journalism. He felt that journalism had not been properly appreciated as an art form, partially because nobody had made it into an art form. And he felt that if a novelist or writer of fiction, as he was, used the techniques of fiction to write about journalism, journalism could be elevated to an art form. And that's what he did with In Cold Blood. Other people had done it before. Truman made somewhat exaggerated claims about what he did, but nobody, in our time anyway, had done it as well as he did. And In Cold Blood has had an enormous influence on other writers, including very good writers like Norman Mailer. I believe that Mailer could not have written his nonfiction books, which came after Truman's, such as The Armies of the Night and the book about Gary Gilmore and so on, if it had not been for In Cold Blood.
He, I think, got in much deeper into the story than he expected to. He got out there to research this murder before the killers had been found, and he didn't expect they'd ever be found. Then the killers were found. He got to know them, to interview them, to witness their execution. What emotional effect did that have on him?
It was horrifying for him because he became very friendly with the killers. He knew that they were killers. He knew that they should be executed. He certainly did not excuse what they had done. He did not want them out on the street, but yet he couldn't help but be sympathetic with them. And I think anybody who reads In Cold Blood has to be sympathetic as well. That's one of the marvels of the book, is that he makes them human. It was a terrible conflict, and Truman felt very guilty about it, and I don't think ever quite recovered. He told me that before In Cold Blood, he was a relatively sane, normal person with the normal neuroses that we all have. And he was right. He had handled his life very well. After In Cold Blood, something snapped. And he was no longer, he lost his balance.
What were some of the ways that he started to physically and mentally deteriorate?
Toward the very end, He, after having taken so many pills, I don't think it was so much the alcohol as it was the pills, he began to hallucinate. The last few months of his life, he thought he was seeing, at some times, and this is not all the time, he thought he was seeing ghosts in his apartment. He came out of the apartment, banged on the doors of his neighbors, saying ghosts were inside or mafia hitmen were inside, waiting to kill him. Of course, none of this was true. It was shocking for everybody. Nobody knew about it outside at the time, however.
Well, you were with him at the time as his biographer. What did you see your role as being? Would you try to help straighten him out or just watch and document it as it happened?
No, I don't believe that a biographer or a journalist has to sit by and just watch somebody kill himself. I did try to help him, and I did, as did other people. I told him he had to stop drinking, that he was going to kill himself. Doctors had told me that, and it was obvious. I knew it was true. But there was really not a great deal any of us could do.
He had been writing for years his book Unanswered Prayers, saying that this book would really establish his reputation as a brilliant writer. Why was he having so much trouble writing? Was it because of the physical problems he was having and the problems with drugs and alcohol? Or do you think that all those problems were a result of the writer's block he was having?
I think a little bit of everything, really. I think he had set his goals too high. It's a wonderful thing for every writer to want to write a great, great book. But some writers are a little bit more realistic about it than Truman was, and Truman himself had been more realistic. In other words, you do your best, and that's all you can do, and you publish. He felt it had to be a masterpiece or nothing, and I think if you sit down every day and think that the words you're writing have to be part of a masterpiece, I think it is a very inhibiting process.
Although he never completed the book, he did write several chapters. One of the chapters that was published in a magazine was Côte La Côte Basque, named after the restaurant in New York. And in this chapter, there's a lot of secrets he revealed about the wealthy and powerful people who were his friends, the people who had taken him in, the people who he had dined with and vacationed with for years and years. And because of the secrets about them that he revealed in this chapter, they turned against him and they shut him out. Did he consider that that was going to happen? He felt terribly rejected afterwards. I mean, I think he felt really...
He was very naive. He showed me the manuscript before it was published, and we went swimming the summer before it was published. In July of 1975, we went swimming. And as he was swimming around in the pool, I read the chapter at the side of the pool, and he explained to me who the models for all the characters were. And it was some of them I knew already. And I said to him, "Truman, when they read this, they're not going to be very happy." And he said, floating around in the pool, looking up at the sky, "Nah, they're too dumb. They won't know who they are." Well, they did know who they were. And there was a kind of an earthquake in New York, and in Los Angeles, too, where some of the people were. And the ground opened up beneath his feet. And people like Babe Paley, who really had been his greatest friend, just dropped him immediately.
You didn't expect this biography to be published posthumously. You know, you didn't expect Capote to be dead at the time
of publication. No. And I'm very sorry, in fact, that he's not here to read it. I think there are certain things he would not like, but I have a feeling most of it he would have liked.
Are there things that you said that you would have withheld had he still been alive?
No. Nothing. I wouldn't have changed a word.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gerald Clark is the author of Capote, a biography of Truman Capote, published by Simon & Schuster. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What do you have for us?
Well, we have a report that the trial of Oliver North is likely to be the first of the four Iran-Contra defendants. You may recall yesterday Judge Gerhard Gesell ordered that the four defendants would have to be tried separately rather than together. Also, a report from the House of Representatives where the Ethics Committee today took up the case of Speaker Jim Wright. They've been petitioned by a number of Republican congressmen to look into the deal by which the Speaker published a book, which was actually published by an old friend and colleague of his. That and news from South Korea, where a major march is planned to the border with North Korea, favoring reconciliation.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, Big, is a big success at the box office. It's a comedy about a boy who becomes a man before his time. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Once upon a time, the makers of Big planned to cast Robert De Niro in its lead role. And as I watched the very pleasant movie that got made with Tom Hanks instead, I couldn't help thinking about the possibilities that were lost along the way. The film's premise is the kind that, by now, has become a genre unto itself. You might call Big a fish-out-of-body movie. 13-year-old Josh Baskin encounters a mysterious carnival wishing machine. He makes one wish. He wants to be big. And he wakes up the next morning, still 13, but in the body of a man who is decidedly 30-something. With De Niro in the lead, this might have been a genuinely dark comedy, a funny nightmare of alienation and loss. As it is, with Hanks delivering his most virtuosic performance, and the director Penny Marshall serving up one punchy sight gag after another, the movie works astonishingly well, but that darkness, which might have made it a classic, is merely hinted at, and then only at the beginning, when Josh is hounded from his New Jersey home into scary New York. Fortunately, he lands a job with a toy manufacturer, and since he sees toys exactly the way 13-year-old kids see them, his insights are hailed as genius. Then, too, there's something ineffably attractive about this child man. Even the office seductress, played by Elizabeth Perkins, notices it when she visits his apartment on their first date. What Josh requires in a woman, it seems, is trampoline skills.
Oh, come on!
I'll do it with you, all right? To show you how good. Ready? Jump, see? Just this. That's all there is. That's all there is to it. There you go. There you go. Yeah. Easy. Anybody can do this.
Big redefines childhood. As you watch Hanks's grown-up body undergo the squirms and tics you may remember from way back when, you begin to see what it means to be a boy in a fresh way. And though Josh often seems closer to 9 than to 13, I guess he has to be 13 so that the love interest can kick in, the movie makes you feel with the force of a revelation how huge an adjustment we all make when we move from youth to adulthood. Some of the movie's adjustments are pretty unconvincing, especially toward the end when we're meant to believe that Josh is feeling adult pressures, that he's pining for the carefree baseball-playing days he's missing. After all, are the pressures of exams and dates and gym class so much less to a kid than the pressures of designing a toy line would be to the grown-up Josh? In the end, Big steamrolls over a lot of interesting questions, but its middle hour is so much fun that it scarcely matters. Hanks's performance is a beauty, though it wouldn't work without the expert reactions of Robert Loggia as the toy company's CEO, and especially Elizabeth Perkins, whose discovery of her own warmer, sweeter self as she falls for Hanks makes for one of the loveliest comic transformations in recent memory. Maybe a little too lovely. After all, one of this movie's underlying messages is that what women really want in men is a little boy, whereas half the women I know are still nursing the wounds they've received from men who more or less were.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with journalist Teresa Carpenter. Her new book is the story of a medical professor's obsession with a Boston prostitute. Like most of the obsessions that Carpenter writes about, it ended in murder. Carpenter won the Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on several murders, including the killing of playmate Dorothy Stratton. Critic at large Laurie Stone will look at the dance and choreography of Marc Morris. And Cajun fiddler Michael Doucette will return with two members of his band Beau Soleil to play some dance music, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistance from Deborah George, Ed Doherty, and Lisa Bruton, who directed today's show. Research assistance from Martin Foyes, Laura Stern, and Deirdre Benzing. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.